millennials are definitely being screwed. You know, I certainly don't favor shutdowns. Israel is committing, I think, the most horrific genocide in our era. I find RFK's position on Gaza and Israel absolutely horrific. He is a genocide supporter. He's a Zionist on steroids. And as someone of Jewish background myself, you know, I want to point the finger at AIPAC for basically inflaming anti-Semitism, for them to make the claim that it's anti-Semitic to oppose Israel. That's like saying it's anti-Semitic to oppose genocide. Everyone who voted for that bill that was passed 2 days ago that essentially commits, you know, what is it, a million children to starvation, every one of them is a war criminal and should be held accountable, and at the very least needs to be removed from office as quickly as possible.
Welcome to 24 for 24, an interview series where I ask presidential candidates 24 pressing questions regarding the 2024 election. Today, we are joined by Jill Stein. She's a Harvard-educated doctor turned environmental health advocate. Back in the 90s, Jill began connecting the dots between toxic exposures and illness, and she's not stopped since. She's helped combat environmental injustice and racism, as well as push for a cleaner, greener world. Jill first ran for the Oval Office in 2012. She became the first Green Party presidential candidate to qualify for public financing. The 2024 election will be Jill's third time running for president. Her platform supports progressive ideas, like securing an economic Bill of Rights, as well as a Green New Deal. Jill takes a lot of criticism from the right and even more from the left, but she keeps fighting for what she believes. Stay tuned and find out why the White House should be green. So the first question is, I'm a millennial, and so the question I have is, are millennials just complainers, or is the wealth engine that boomers benefited from gone?
Oh, I think there's no question about it. Millennials are definitely being screwed. There's a huge generational gap in just about everything, including income, jobs, access to housing, and above all, debt, student debt. And there are many causes of this, but you know, we have a political system where the rules get made by the big spenders, you know, by bankers and billionaires, and the wealthy, the rich, are calling the shots, so the shots are working for the rich. And it's been a slow downhill course. If you look at, like, the economy, wealth and power, well, so let's start with wealth. Wealth has been super concentrated over a matter of decades to where now three billionaires have as much wealth as half of the population. So, you know, there's an old saying that says we have a choice between vast concentrations of wealth or a democracy. In this country, we have super vast concentrations of wealth. So that's translated into huge political power as the major parties, the Democrats and Republicans, are really controlled by their big donors. And so you have the best democracy money can buy, which is no democracy at all. It's serving the very few at the top. And young people have really been taking it on the chin. Whatever indicator you're looking at, things are really, really tough for young people who've really been kind of grandfathered out of everything that works. And so, yes, life is tough. And so, like, how would my administration fix it? It's a number of fixes. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest fix is to get big money out of the business of running our government, because it's that, like, corporate control of government. It's this sold out, corrupted, legally corrupted government that is the overarching problem. We need to get money out of politics. We need to close the revolving door so that our politicians and our agencies are not controlled by, you know, the foxes who are currently running the chicken coop, whether you're looking at, you know, the FDA or the FAA, where Boeing gets to call the shots on Boeing's regulations, where the Sackler family got to call the shots on opioids and wrote, you know, the regulations basically for opioids. They cashed in, made billions, but, you know, we're left with this outrageous, drug problem, overdose problem, 100,000 people every year. Healthcare, you know, it's like few people can afford it. Well, it's like 87 million who can't afford healthcare. You know, we're paying twice as much as the next biggest payer globally. And yet our health outcomes and our health statistics are totally in the tank. So there are any number of reforms that are tested. Other countries have them. They work well. We need, in my view, we need an economic bill of rights. We need good living wages. We need a right to a job. We need free public higher education. We know that every dollar we put into higher education returns to the larger economy $7. We know that from the GI Bill. This is a, you know, this is a terrific investment. As far as I'm concerned, we need to cancel student debt. We canceled, we bailed out the banks when they crashed the economy in 2008. And that's the least we can do for a generation that was really misled into, you know, lifelong debt servitude. And there are, you know, real critical disabling things now for the entire economy and especially for the generation, the younger generation. But these are fixable. In the Green Party, we don't take big money. We don't work with super PACs. We don't, take dark money through various legal runarounds. So we are of, by, and for the people and have the liberty to actually pass policies that work for everyday people, not just for the billionaires and the corporations.
Okay, just to follow up on that a little bit, if you do become president, you're going to have the Republican and Democrat legislature. They're not going to want to do any of this because they've been running the show forever. Would you do this through executive order then? How would you get these people-driven ideas and like concepts into law? Because they're not going to want to do anything you want.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the hope, well, the plan, shall we say. First of all, I won't come to office without there being a very strong grassroots movement, which could elect not a majority of Congress, but there are many good candidates who are running who are also independent of this very corrupt system. So there would be allies. But beyond that, you know, the name of the game is to, our elected officials are supposed to represent us. They're supposed to represent their constituents. And right now, they don't meet with their constituents. They don't hold town hall meetings. You know, they are not open to dialogue and instruction, which is the way democracy is supposed to work. Our elected officials are supposed to represent us, not the big lobbyists and campaign donors. So, you know, the president has the bully pulpit, and the president can help maintain that grassroots movement, which is essential, so that we're going to be holding our elected officials accountable. And, you know, there are a series of reforms that could change this, like closing the revolving door and getting big money out of the business of running our elections. But those require reforms. However, those reforms could be orchestrated, supported by a large grassroots movement. So I really see the role of president as being organizer in chief and advocate in chief, not for the lobbyists for a change, but for everyday people. So all of this would be a fight. And you're absolutely right that it's not like we get elected and the struggle is over. No, it's like we get elected and the struggle is just beginning.
I'm a millennial, and a lot of us are really tired of seeing nepotism. Trump put his family all inside the administration. You see this top and down through politics, even business, but I'm tired of it. Would you pledge to not put any of your family or friends into your administration?
Absolutely. You know, I think people need to be well qualified. I mean, and you can look at the way my campaign is run. There are zero family members who have anything to do with my campaign. I mean, my family goes running. If I start talking politics, they're out of here, you know. So there's no danger of that, that's for sure. And, you know, there are people that I know and who have been colleagues who are trusted you know, administrators and staff. So it's not like knowing someone is a wipeout, you know, that they can be considered, but they have to meet really strict criteria. And yeah, no, I share your concerns about that, and I see it all the time.
Okay, glad to hear that. I interviewed two libertarians before you, and they kind of went around in circles, like, well, the most qualified, but they wouldn't say no family. So I'm glad to hear you say that. I love that answer.
Yeah, good. Good. I mean, I'd say what you see is what you get, you know, and there's nobody that has any relation, you know, any family relation whatsoever who has anything to do with me or, you know, the politics that I work with.
We'll move right along to a few COVID questions. So the first one is, do you support a constitutional Great. Amendment to prevent the government from mandating any vaccine?
So, you know, the constitutional amendment that we need, in my view, is to keep special interests out of the business of defining our policies, whether it's health policy, transportation policy, you know, energy policy, the rest. The foxes should not be guarding the chicken coop, no matter what their position is. And, you know, as a medical doctor, you know, I feel like it's science and community values that really have to drive health policy and public health policy. And the two go together. I don't think science exists in a vacuum. And, you know, public opinion needs to be informed and engaged. And it's always a complex interaction. And the science is changing constantly. So throughout my career, I have not supported mandates. I believe people need to be educated and to make informed choices on a one-to-one basis. You know, I've never been the kind of doctor that dictates to patients what the proper health choices should be. These are choices, and they all have pros and cons, and they all interface with our values. And I think the same thing is true at the public health and policy level, that we need to have people engaged. We need to have science which is accessible to the public. It's got to be transparent, and it cannot be funded by special interests, which is a big problem right now. Both that science is funded by special interests, you know, forever you have pharmaceutical corporations that are sponsoring these studies, and it biases the waters. So in my view, we need a constitutional amendment to keep special interests out of government. And then we need to ensure that government is us, that it is we the people, it's accountable to us, and it has to be transparent. So I avoid writing any policy in stone anywhere. You know, I think it all has to be subject to constant scrutiny, constant watchdogging. So I wouldn't write it one way or the other, especially not into the Constitution, where it takes quite a while. You know, like, what if we had a super Ebola, for example? You could imagine a circumstance that, you know, people are absolutely terrified and society is falling like flies. You know, you may need a different policy than what has served you before. So I feel like we need to, we need to have a basic set of rules that allows us to use our minds, our hearts, and our values to constantly mid-course correct. That is the essence of democracy and, I think, good health policy. You have to constantly watchdog it, demand that it be explained, debate it publicly, because it's never clear-cut, believe me. Health policy, even, you know, like the most basic things, and they evolve in a very difficult way. You know, like germ theory way back, you know, in the 1800s, germ theory was disputed, and the doctors would not accept that they had to wash their hands before going into surgery. But the nurses and the midwives, they got it, you know, and so there were no infections and deaths from infection on the midwife floors, but there were lots of deaths on the doctor floors, you know. So it's like change is very difficult. As a society and as professions that get trained up and very invested in things. So we've got to have debates. You know, we've got to have debates. And science has to be explained. It cannot be written in language that you need a PhD and a medical degree in order to understand.
kind of along those similar lines, does the government have a right to ever implement a mask mandate or disease testing mandates like we saw with the COVID testing?
Yeah. In my view, I never say never, you know, especially on health policies, because you can't predict what's going to happen. I don't, as a rule, favor mandates, you know, and I think the same applies here, whether you're talking masks or shutdowns. You know, I certainly don't favor shutdowns, but when Europe did shutdowns, they paid the businesses. So you didn't have the collapse of small businesses, which is what you had here, because COVID policy basically favored big donors and favored large corporations, as well as, you know, pharmaceutical companies, big pharma. So, you know, I think we have to take the influence out and not lock ourselves in to one policy or another. We have to be willing to do the science, to look at the science, to watchdog it, explain it, and debate it.
Okay, so kind of keep things flexible. Okay. Another COVID question here. Would you abide by or cancel the international health regulation amendments being considered by the World Health Organization?
So actually, I will have to do more research on that. I wasn't able to find those in a quick search, but you know, I'd be glad to get back to you on that. If you want to send me some links to that, I'm not aware of what they are.
We'll just switch total gears here for an economic question. What is your position on central bank digital currency?
So there are a few things that I understand about currencies. I don't pretend to completely grasp this. It's a little bit above my pay grade. We will eventually have a policy on this that you know, our consultants will advise on. But what I do understand is that there are huge privacy issues here. This becomes kind of a vast centralized database, and I think, you know, our privacy doesn't exist right now. You know, all our personal data is sold freely. And it doesn't take China, you know, to spy on us. In fact, I think China's doing less spying on us than our own government. And so that's one big impediment in my view. I don't want to be part of a central database where government knows the details of how you're spending every last penny and all the rest. The other concern is that because of the blockchain process, it's extremely energy intensive. And as I understand this process, for I think it's, you know, even just for Bitcoin, consumes as much more energy actually than many nations. And we would need to find a workaround on that. So I guess you'd say, from what I know currently, I don't feel good about it, but I'm open to, you know, to further discussion and information.
So this point of the interview, I like to ask a question that kind of challenges the party that you're running on. When I had the libertarians on, I asked them why women reject libertarianism. A little bit different for the Green Party. I don't think it's considered to be like women aren't involved in it. So for you, the question is, how do you get beyond the stereotype that the Green Party is just recycling old socialist or communist ideas? And in an article from FEE, it accuses the party of being, quote, just like a watermelon, green on the outside, red on the inside. What is your response to that?
So first, what is FEE?
Foundation for Economic, oh, I don't have that whole, it's a more right-leaning foundation,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I just hear that a lot about Green Party.
Because, you know, it's funny when I'm out. Yeah. Okay. The criticism I hear actually is that, oh, you're just about the environment. You're just about the climate. You know, where are social issues? Where's racial justice? Where's LGBTQ justice? You know, and to my mind, that is, it's about an old stereotype. You know, from where I sit, you know, and I'm not fundamentally an ideological person. I'm a practical person. I'm a doctor. You know, I think about what do we do and how do we get better from this, you know, state of chronic and acute disease that we're living in. You know, I mean, we're a very sick society. We have a sick healthcare system. You know, sickness, our economy is sick. You know, it sort of applies across the board. So I'm kind of pragmatic thinking. And, you know, what I hear out there is that people like they like the word socialist, especially young people who feel like they've been so screwed and that the world is being run by the economic elites. So, you know, and polls would suggest that too, especially among younger people. But the view of socialism in general is becoming more and more favorable, actually. And if there's anything that's a drag on the Greens, it's this notion that we're just about the environment. And we're definitely not. We are, you know, there are four pillars to the Green Party. There's ecological wisdom or sustainability, grassroots democracy, which means basically decentralized power to the people. You know, the people need to engage their government. We are the government. It's nothing without us. We have to watchdog it, and we need to be in the driver's seat, not big, powerful economic and political elites. Peace and, you know, anti-war, that, you know, war is kind of the big ripoff that is constantly exploiting us and controlling our government, you know, the military-industrial complex, as Dwight Eisenhower warned us. It's alive and well. It's here. The average household, by the way, spent $12,000 this year in the tax base to support the endless war machine and the Pentagon and its various abuses. So that is a major pillar. And then social and racial justice and gender justice, I would add. So, you know, I think the mainstream media takes great pains not to cover Greens because we're considered a threat. We don't buy into the control by the elites. And so they're mostly all about smearing us in whatever way we can. And, you know, but I'd encourage people to go to our website, JillStein2024.com, and find out about it.
Got a couple questions here on criminal justice system. What actions would you take to end the war on drugs?
So the war on drugs is like a complete disaster, really initiated under the Nixon administration, who stated, actually, who was it? It was John Ehrlichman, the White House domestic advisor, who explained the purpose of the drug policy was to basically get back at the anti-war movement and at people of color that they perceived as not being their friends. You know, so that's really what the drug wars were about, and to some extent, I mean, they still are about. But now the disaster of these drug policies, it hits hardest in communities of color, but it's all over the place. You know, almost 110,000 people last year died from overdoses. You know, the war on drugs just fuels mass incarceration. You know, nonviolent drug use and sales, you know, populates our jails, huge numbers. And this also fuels the cartels and the violence, especially south of the border, which then is then fueling the migrant crisis. And that is one thing, by the way, that the president can do on day one, which is to begin legalizing drugs and ensuring that there are other modes of treatment. Drug use disorder, and it is a disorder, it needs to be treated as a mental health problem. And that way it can be successfully treated. Simply throwing people into jail, you know, is by no means workable. So, you know, and it just aggravates the problem. And people come out of jail and then their life is screwed, and then they resort to lives of crime again out of necessity. And, you know, we have just a revolving door prison system, you know, and we incarcerate more people than any other country on a percentage basis. So, yeah, absolutely. We need to end the war on drugs. We need to end prohibition. We need to implement safer use programs so that people are not dying like flies. And that means safer supply and safer consumption sites. We need addiction treatment and recovery. And we need to address what a disaster zone our economy is, because so many people don't have real options and their view of life is one of, you know, hopelessness. And polls show that young people in particular like half of young people consider their lives hopeless, consider the future hopeless. One quarter of young people have considered doing harm to themselves because of the hopelessness of things. That's got to be addressed too. And that's what our broader economic policies are about, giving everyday people a fighting chance in the economy instead of just loading people up with debt, denying people health care, affordable housing, and all the rest. We need to fix the underlying drivers of the hopelessness and the extreme stress and the mental health crisis that our society has become.
Okay, I want to kind of piggyback and go back to what you mentioned about incarceration, how we incarcerate more people than any other country in terms of sheer numbers and per capita. You mix in that about 80% of our SWAT raids are for drug-related crimes, and also consider that more than 180 people have been exonerated from death row. Taking this together, why is it the criminal justice system is broken and corrupt, and how would you go about fixing it from like a whole aspect altogether?
Well, our criminal justice system became a whole lot more sick, dysfunctional, massive with the drug wars. And, you know, we can go right back to Bill Clinton and Joe Biden even for those rules and that legislation. And, you know, it also goes back to Richard Nixon and his war on drugs. So it's been a bipartisan affair. And again, I think it exemplifies how the predators really are running the show here and are defining policy that has created a very prosperous system of private incarceration. That's certainly part of the problem. Prison labor is used and abused within that system. There are all kinds of reasons why, you know, you had this, the dismantling of our whole mental health care system. And where did people go? They went into jail. Same is true for the mental health crisis. A huge proportion of police interactions then, you know, are driven by mental health crises. And there's no reason for police to have to be burdened with that. That's not their training. That's not what they know how to do. You know, and we're seeing our in the same way that our national budget is consumed by militarism, half of it, you know, half of the congressional budget is basically spent on the Pentagon and endless wars that make us less safe, not more safe. Well, in the same way that our national budget, in the same way that our national budget is consumed by global policing, our domestic budgets and our urban budgets, our cities, are also consumed. It's not unusual for a city to be spending half of its budget on policing and the system related to policing, jails, and so forth. And this isn't working. You know, we keep spending more and more money on it, and it keeps getting worse and worse. So, you know, in terms of why this has happened, in my view, this is part of the, you know, the hijack of all of our systems of democracy that are, again, not serving we the people. And, you know, especially the least fortunate, that is communities of color, really get caught in the target hairs here. So, for example, now homelessness is being criminalized, too. And we see these laws being passed that, you know, that make it a criminal offense if you're caught sleeping in a public place. You know, Florida just passed this legislation. And, you know, this is about basically criminalizing poverty. You know, we have a society that criminalizes, you know, everybody who's not kind of in the economic and political elite. And this is just another example of it. And this has to change. You know, we need... non-policing systems of community safety. We can prevent so many of the petty criminal problems by ensuring that people have a decent education and access to jobs. Lots of crime is poverty-driven. by making sure that we have a mental health system and that we have health care for everyone as a human right. And under the system we propose, which is basically an improved Medicare for All system, it cuts out the red tape and the bureaucracy, and it makes sure that everybody has access to mental health care as well as health care, which right now very few people have. It's extremely expensive. It's generally not covered or only for a very short period of time. You know, we don't have the social workers that we need. It's the needs of everyday people have totally gotten sacrificed in order to meet the inordinate appetite of the military-industrial complex and the policing-industrial complex, you know, and the incarceration-industrial complex. So, you know, we need to return power to the people, in my view. And, you know, and again, this is part of that system of shutting down the whole-scale hijack of our policies by the economic elites and the political system that supports that. And I would just include in this just one quick add-on, which is that the private prison system has to go. Mixing prison and profit is just, you know, is a prescription for disaster. And, you know, we have to end the use of private prisons for immigrants as well as for our jails and our prisons.
Want to get on to some election questions next here. So do you believe the 2020 election was stolen, be fake ballots, mules, mail-in voting scams? What's your opinion on that?
So I have not seen evidence, either in my own purview or reviewed by the courts, that validated any of those claims, actually. And there were so many different courts that were involved in this. It becomes a pretty compelling body of judgment and evidence. There are ways, however, I would say, that our election system is very corrupted. This didn't start in 2020. This has been ongoing for a long time. It greatly increased with Citizens United when unlimited amounts of money could be thrown into the election, and basically the economic elites can buy their candidates, and then they can buy the campaigns and the political advertising to really create a very corrupted, propagandized system. So in that sense, I think elections are very subject to rigging. Right now you're looking at the Democrats. They just announced that they will, they are engaging an army of lawyers so that they can basically use all kinds of trivia and dirty tricks, which they've been known to use, in order to throw their competitors off the ballot. This is absolutely outrageous. This is a complete violation of basic principles of democracy, and it is jaw-dropping that they're actually saying this out loud. You know, they don't even get that this is shameful, that they've announced that they are out to smear. They say, highlight the unsavory aspects of their competitors' characters, you know, aka propaganda and smear campaigns, and that they are trying to complicate our ballot access battles. And let me give an example of how they complicate it. This was well demonstrated in 2020 when the DNC tried to throw a Green Senate candidate off the ballot in North Carolina. And they undertook a campaign of deception. You know, they talk about the Russians interfering in elections. Well, this is like interference on steroids, where they were calling people who signed the ballot petition for Matt Ho, the Senate candidate, to get on the ballot. They were calling them and impersonating the Green Party, saying that they were the Green Party and that they wanted to get, they decided Matt Ho shouldn't run and wanted to get him off the ballot. Well, they just happened to call the co-chair of the North Carolina Green Party, Tony Andege, who had the presence of mind to start recording the call. So that call is actually in the public domain. You can hear them hemming and hawing, pretending to be the Green Party when he challenges them and says, no, you're not the Green Party. We're not doing anything like that. And this is like typical of the dirty tricks that that they run. So, you know, hold on to your hat. We're about to see the real democracy interference that gets so much lip service. You know, there's no greater perpetrator of election interference than our major parties.
Well, speaking of major parties and trying to push people off the ballot, my next question is about RFK. He left the Democratic Party. He's running independent now. What is your opinion of him? We've not really seen a third-party candidate get that much pull probably since Ross Perot. What do you think about his campaign, his platform? Do you think he'll just dwindle out? He's so controversial of a figure.
You know, I think it's good for the pot to be stirred. And I think that's what democracy is about. You have people running that you may not like and whose policies you may not like. But I believe the American people have the right to that choice. But the American people also have a right to the First Amendment, which means not only our free speech, it's also freedom of the press. We need a press that's not hijacked by big financial interests so that we actually can hear. The job of the press is to educate the people. This is why we have a First Amendment, and it's why it's number one, because without an educated electorate, you know, it's kind of hopeless. We cannot be our own, you know, investigators. We need the press to do its job, and kudos to independent press like yourself that's asking a lot of the questions that the mainstream press won't. And in my view, we need to break up the press monopolies. We need to, you know, as of about 10 years ago, it was like six major corporations that controlled 90% of the print media. And, you know, that's outrageous. That's a violation of the First Amendment. We need lots of perspectives and lots of voices, and we don't get that. So, you know, in terms of my own opinion about RFK, I think he's largely running on the Kennedy name. You know, if you look at his ad for the the big football game, it was all about the Kennedy name, and that's what he's doing, and that's been some of his success. But he's also worked around the censorship of mainstream media, and that's a very important, that's an important lesson that we are breaking away from mainstream corporate media, and that is really to the credit of all the independent media that's out there. I find RFK's position on Gaza and Israel absolutely horrific. He is a genocide supporter. He's a Zionist on steroids. He is working hand in glove with big donors from that community, and I find that kind of shameful. He talks about getting money out of politics, but he's up to his eyeballs in it and is working with a super PAC, you know, which is supposed to be conducting his ballot access drive, which is questionable in and of itself. But that super PAC violates his claims that he believes in getting big money out of politics, you know. So he exemplifies the watch what I say, not what I do. But I think, you know, we need to hold all politicians accountable, even if they are new. They all need to be held accountable, both on the basis of what they've done and what they're doing now, even if it's just a campaign, even if they haven't held office. You know, I think people need to be held accountable, and his words and his actions don't really comport. To my mind, that doesn't mean take him off the ballot. That means, you know, we all need to be subject to scrutiny.
The next question I have here is about January 6th. I'm going to read it because it's kind of a loaded question. Protesters from January 6th have received a combined total of nearly 850 years worth of prison sentences. Individuals like Zach Real, Joe Biggs, Stuart Rhodes, and Enrique Otario received the longest sentences, ranging from 15 to 22 years. Those are longer than the four people who got term sentences at the Nuremberg trials. So my question for you is, why should they serve longer sentences than actual Nazis? And as president, would you commute or not, if not completely pardon, all nonviolent January 6th protesters? That was kind of a loaded question there.
Yeah, I guess I would have to look more carefully at their actual charges. You know, when I look at January 6th, it was dangerous. People broke laws. They should be held accountable for breaking laws. But whether the sentences were reasonable, I would have to dive more into the weeds than I have done. In the, you know, in the big scheme, I see a lot around January 6th as being blown up for political reasons. Not that it was a harmless event, it was a serious and problematic event. But I really see the two sides as extremely polarized, and it's like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And to my mind, that just really underscores why we need a civil conversation, why we need to get money out of politics again, because we've got these two very polarized sides that, you know, it's like communications have completely broken down. And it seems to me that you really have to develop the basis for a more human conversation. And it's really hard to begin the conversation right there, which is where things are, you know, extremely polarized and, you know, kind of hopeless. I don't see one side prevailing over the other, but I, you know, in my view, we have to begin having a conversation that's outside of the box, and that it's not, you know, well, Democrats think this and Republicans think this, and we're going to go to war with each other over that. You know, in my view, we have to start by solving our critical problems for everyday people, that people get polarized and they get demagogued because their lives are pretty miserable and they are ready to get angry. You know, this was the point of view that Bernie Sanders also gave voice to, which is that if you want to sort of take the neo-fascism out of America, you got to start addressing the unmet needs of everyday working people. And that's kind of where my focus is, because I feel like punishing one side or the other doesn't get us there. It just gets us into further polarization and violence, and that we've got to really start by addressing the needs of everyday working people.
We will switch gears again, and we'll get into some international issues here. Is funding Ukraine or Israel's wars in America's national security interest? And then kind of as a caveat to that, is Israel committing genocide? You briefly touched on that a minute ago, so just kind of flesh that out some more.
Yeah, so yes, Israel is committing, I think, the most horrific genocide in our era. The speed with which people... Excuse me. Sorry about that. The speed of destruction and the intensity of it is absolutely unprecedented. So the genocide is horrific, and it really needs to be stopped immediately. The genocide going on in Gaza, you know, Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, referred to Israel as America's unsinkable battleship in the Middle East, basically safeguarding the supply of oil. We don't need that oil supply anymore. We're now the biggest exporter of oil. But the U.S. wants to control everybody else's oil. This is a policy, this is our military policy that's been written into basic Pentagon policy. It's called full spectrum dominance. It's this idea that the U.S. should be the dominant player, the dominant military force, the dominant economic force, and that we should dominate all spheres, whether it's cyberspace, outer space, the surface of the sea, under the sea, the battlefield. We should dominate it all in all regions of the world. This is the explicit U.S. policy since the mid-1990s. And, you know, it's a deadly policy, and it's no longer appropriate for today's world. We were top dog coming out of the Second World War when the other industrialized nations were basically bombed to smithereens. So their economies were destroyed. We emerged as the dominant player from the Second World War, militarily and economically. And we're not in that position anymore. You know, the BRICS alliance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and now Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries, they control more of the global GDP than the U.S. and its allies in NATO do. So we are no longer economically, you know, in the dominant position. And in fact, those curves have crossed, and they are continuing to diverge. So it's been a while in coming. This didn't just happen overnight. This is a very well-established trend. So we have to start becoming a team player. You know, fancy that. We can't be the bully in the schoolyard anymore. This is the problem with our national policy. It consumes half of our budget. As Martin Luther King said, my country is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. We were back then, we are now. We're spending about $1 trillion a year. We actually have special anti-terror operations going on in 85 countries around the world right now, if you can believe that. That's how far the iron grip of U.S. militarism goes. According to the Senate, the Congressional Research Service, we have sent the military into other countries 250 times in the past 30 years. So it's just staggering how militarism dominates U.S. policy and its cost to us. I mentioned before, it's $12,000 per household just this year for the costs of militarism. And that's according to Jeffrey Sachs from the Columbia University Department of Sustainable Development. So these are pretty well-founded figures. And what do we get for this overblown militarism? We get failed states like Libya, mass refugee migrations like we're receiving right now, and continuing terrorist threats. You know, we had a big hand in Al-Qaeda, ISIS, the Taliban, you name it. These have been very much U.S.-designed plans that backfired against us big time. We've overthrown something around 70 governments since the Second World War, and that's not even the wars. These are just overthrows by the CIA, like everything from Guatemala to Iran, and, you know, look how well that worked, you know. Basically, this creates generations of chaos and devastation, and the crisis at the southern border is just an example of that. Like Haiti, Honduras, you name them, one after the other. These are disasters of our own making here, usually on behalf of corporations or their wars, overthrowing Iran's democratically elected government back in the 1950s was all about preventing them from basically having sovereignty over their own oil supply. That's why we overthrew Iran and installed the Shah, you know, who was a vicious dictator that then gave way to the Iranian Revolution. You know, this is just nonsense. You know, this is about the raw exercise of power. It doesn't serve any purpose except to keep the military-industrial complex, you know, fat and happy and in the position of calling the shots. This is why we really need a peaceful revolution so that we can have a government that serves the people's interests, because right now our foreign policy, and this applies to Ukraine as well, you know, foreign policy is serving the special interests, and it is not serving the American people. It's impoverishing us by the cost, and it is endangering us, because these crises, all in the age of nuclear weapons, we're all in the in the crosshairs here of nuclear weapons. Using them anywhere basically puts us all at risk, because, as you know, nuclear weapons create what's called nuclear winter. They kick up so much debris in these very powerful explosions in the mushroom clouds. Debris is being kicked up into the upper atmosphere where it doesn't come down. You can't rain it down. It stays there for years, and actually for decades, and massively depresses food production. So we all starve, and just one nuclear submarine worth of nuclear weapons, which is about 4,000 Hiroshima bombs, is the equivalent of a nuclear submarine. That much firepower is enough to put us into substantial nuclear winter and kill off what might be a third, might be half, might be more of the entire global population, which means basically the end of civilization as we know it. So we're all in the target hairs of these criminal policies and these violations of international law, which, you know, Gaza and the genocide represent really full-blown. Ukraine is another example of that. This was a war that should have been avoided. We knew absolutely what we were getting into. We went back on our word. Our word was not to expand NATO 1 inch to the east of Germany at the time. Germany was reunified after the Second World War, and what Russia wanted, it was very clear and explicit. Russia wanted Ukraine to be neutral. That's what they wanted. Nothing more than that. They wanted neutrality, like Austria coming out of the Second World War. And the U.S. absolutely refused to negotiate, refused to accede to that point. And within 2 or 3 months after Russia invaded, in order to stop the placement of nuclear-compatible missiles all along its border. That's basically what that complaint was about. We did the same thing when Russia was placing nuclear missiles in Cuba. We launched the aircraft that could drop the nuclear bombs. But fortunately, we had leaders with the good sense to negotiate. And they did. Khrushchev and Kennedy negotiated against the advice of each of their foreign policy teams. We had independent-minded leaders who were capable of acting on behalf of humanity. Right now, we don't. We have kind of idiots who are taking their marching orders from the military-industrial complex. And I'll say Russia was prepared to negotiate. It was the U.S. that kept refusing. And even when negotiations were taking place under the auspices of Turkey. This was in like March and April of 2022. There were very successful negotiations that were close to being completed when the U.S. and the U.K. went in and instructed Ukraine that they had to, Zelensky, that he had to pull out. So we have created this road to hell. But it's hell mainly for the Ukrainians, who are paying to the teeth here, essentially losing a generation, hundreds of thousands of people who've been wiped out. And they're losing. They're continuing to lose. And still the U.S. is trying to goad them on. It's really horrific. This is not a good use of our taxpayer dollars. This is not a good use of Ukrainian lives. And it's absolutely outrageous that they are being used here essentially for a political battle on behalf of the U.S. It's really criminal, and it should all come to a screeching halt immediately. And it will. Under our administration, we would bring both of these wars to an immediate end and to negotiated solutions, which is, you know, right back where we should have been at the start. And one other thing to add. Great. I'll add just one more thing, which is that international law needs to rule the day here. And international law says that what Israel is doing is absolutely outrageous, from home demolitions to ethnic cleansing to the use of food as a weapon to the targeting of civilians. I mean, everything that Israel is doing it basically is a violation of international law. This is absolutely horrific. So when people say, oh, it's so complicated, what do? Actually, the answer is pretty simple. We compel Israel, which we have the ability to do. Joe Biden could pick up the phone right now, like Ronald Reagan did when Israel had gone into Lebanon and was conducting a war in Lebanon. Ronald Reagan said, stop, bring your troops home, and Lebanon and Israel complied. We are paying for 80% of the weapons that are being used now. You know, a bill was passed 2 days ago. You know, this so-called budget bill is actually a child starvation bill, is what this bill is. It denies food aid to Israel by UNRWA, UNRWA. It denies UNRWA funding to distribute food aid to Gaza at a time when almost 2 million people are on the verge of starvation. And actually, they are in the early stages of starvation. Some of them are in advanced stages of starvation, and people have begun to die, especially the vulnerable children and the elderly we're not even seeing or hearing about. I mean, how many of these deaths are taking place which are completely unreported, especially when they're deaths by starvation and dehydration? This is just, it's like watching the torture of children, the systematic mass torture of children, torture and murder that's going on before our very eyes. And what the U.S. is doing is giving this the thumbs up, normalizing it, and paying for it. It's just criminal, And to my mind, everyone who voted for that bill that was passed 2 days ago that essentially commits, you know, what is it, a million children to starvation, every one of them is a war criminal and should be held accountable. And at the very least, needs to be removed from office as quickly as possible.
Why is it that people can't see it's a genocide? I know politicians are bought off by the Jewish lobby, but what is it with everyday people that see these starving kids and it just doesn't compute? How do we convince them that this is genocide?
Yeah, great. And let me just make a comment here, because, you know, it's AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the driver. And as someone of Jewish background myself, you know, I want to point the finger at AIPAC for basically inflaming anti-Semitism, because the world now is taking this as a Jewish crime because of AIPAC and Israel's role here. But in fact, many Jews, like myself, are vehemently opposed to this and are among the strongest resistance to it, and are out there getting arrested, you know, by the thousands to try to stop this and doing everything we possibly can. But there is a whole new wave of anti-Semitism coming out of this, as well as Islamophobia coming out of this. And I want to lay that squarely at the feet of AIPAC, which is trying to conflate Zionism with Judaism. They are different. And when Zionism first arose in the 1800s, it was viewed as very controversial, and it was disapproved of by formal Jewish organizations. Now, for various reasons, they have worked their way here into acceptability, and I think money has everything to do with that, buying their way into acceptability, and certainly they've bought their way. That's how AIPAC works, and AIPAC has already, come out saying that they're going to spend $100 million now defeating the opponents of genocide. And for them to make the claim, our leaders, you know, who try to conflate Zionism and Judaism, for them to make the claim that it's anti-Semitic to oppose Israel, that's like saying it's anti-Semitic to oppose genocide. And, you know, that is just unbelievable. I froze there for a second. Did that freeze for you, or was that just on my computer? Great. Okay. All right. Terrific. Because, you know, I was like making the take-home point there, which is that it is not anti-Semitic to oppose Israel. And to say it's anti-Semitic to oppose Israel is like saying it's anti-Semitic to oppose genocide. And that's really outrageous. To your basic question about, you know, how did we get here? Again, you know, I think this is that problem of a political system that's bought and paid for. So you have the financial power of the weapons industry, which is huge. The war profiteers regularly buy policy. They offer jobs around it. You know, this is why Bernie Sanders, for so many years, would not speak out against militarism and, you know, the military-industrial complex, because there were jobs. There are jobs. There are jobs everywhere, and they place those jobs in such a way as to guarantee the support of Congress. And we just have to stare that down, you know, and we have to make this impossible for our government to be bought. And this is the price that we pay if we allow ourselves to be bought. We pay the price of genocide. We pay the price of becoming the pariah among nations, which the U.S. has now become together with Israel. And we pay the price of wars that bounce back to bite us. You know, Americans are being evacuated from places all over the world because we've caused so much chaos and danger. And we have to start, not just reining in, but we have to slam shut, you know, these doors of influence peddling, which is essentially how our political system works. We have to bring it to an end. And the president, you know, does, even when Congress appropriates money for for weapons. The president says when those weapons move. So the president can begin to shut them down immediately, both to Ukraine and to Israel. We know that Israel is a massive violator of human rights, to put it mildly, and is standing in the way of the distribution of food and humanitarian aid. So that right there makes it illegal for the U.S. to be sending aid. It's illegal in terms of international law, and it's illegal in terms of U.S. law. So we will stop this on day one. We will shut down both of these wars and, you know, and call out AIPAC and work to have AIPAC classified as a foreign agent, as it should be, because it is advocating for policies on behalf of a foreign government. It's for Israel. And actually, John F. Kennedy was about to so classify the predecessor of AIPAC just before he was assassinated, unfortunately. So this is fixable. And I would add finally that to stop the genocide, you know, we not only need to stop the weapons, we also need to implement a policy of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. This has been proposed at the UN level. We need to get behind that because this has to be shut down immediately.
Why is it, though, that just everyday people can't see this genocide? I'll put content on my platform or talk to people in everyday life, and I always wonder, I know politicians are bought off, that they're corrupt, but how can some other person not see kids dying? Is there just a problem in this country? People are callous? Or I don't understand everyday people not seeing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a tribute to the power of propaganda. You know, the same thing was true in Germany, you know, during the Holocaust, that genocides typically piggyback on long-standing propaganda that dehumanizes the victim. You know, I mean, there are many conditions that usually come together to create genocide, and there's now a whole area of study, you know, called genocide studies. And having read some of these, they're really interesting to see sort of what's the system behind this that enables a genocide to take place. And one of them is systematic, long-standing dehumanization. Same thing, you know, inside of Israel, where people have been miseducated really for generations. And I was listening to a historian named Ilan Pape, who is one of the Israeli historians who began to examine declassified top-secret information about what actually happened at the founding of the State of Israel. And he was one of the first historians that began to really blow the whistle on Zionism as a you know, as a violation of human rights from the get-go. But one of the points he was making is that he himself was observing how Jewish children in Israel were being propagandized and how their textbooks were written, and, you know, how, you know, kibbutzes were being built on homes and villages that had just been destroyed that belonged to Palestinians, and they were living 3 miles from the border, but educated not to think about the people on the other side of the border as being human beings. So, you know, again, it speaks to the importance of a free press as a source of education, as a source of watchdogging what's actually going on, so that we can be an informed electorate and not get sucked into things like supporting genocide. But I do find that, you know, over the course of the last 10 years even, there's been really a profound re-education here in the American public. And in as much as we've been very, you know, propagandized into believing that Israel can do no evil, see no evil, hear no evil, you know, people have really begun to rethink that in a very big way. And it does seem like, you know, the numbers, to look at polls, are just growing, the numbers who do see this as a genocide. And it may take more education and discussion, but it does seem to be, you know, doing the job.
Okay. It's frustrating. I get so sick of people not seeing the genocide, but I guess it's just the country we live in.
It is hard.
We will move on to...
And the very biased...
No, go ahead.
the very biased, communications and the very biased press that we have that's constantly miseducating people. So there's a lot of disinformation that they have to overcome to actually see what's really happening. So I'd say keep up your good work.
Okay, thanks. We'll kind of move on maybe to something a little lighter. You've made it over halfway through. These next questions are going to be a little bit kind of all over the place. So I want to start with parental rights. Does the government or the parents have the ultimate control over a child? And if it's the parents, isn't banning gender-affirming surgeries a violation of their parental rights?
I basically agree with that. And I think this will be one of those questions that I answer in a lightning round fashion so we can get through these. But yes, at the end of the day, it is, except in very extraordinary, abusive and dangerous situations, parents are, the guardians properly of their children. And in such a personal and subjective decision like involving the health of the child, I think, and especially where the medical profession is in agreement here, that this is between the child and their parents and their healthcare provider. This is not where government should be introducing its heavy hand into this process.
Okay, fast and quick, I like it. Next one is about disaster management. In the last year, we had two major and likely preventable disasters, the fire in Lahaina and then the East Palestine train derailment. Both of those catastrophes have triggered a lot of Americans into thinking something nefarious was going on, some conspiracy theories. So to you, I ask, was something nefarious going on in those instances? And then what would be a Green Party president's disaster response? What would that look like to those incidents?
Yeah, so I would say there's something nefarious going on in that there were very misguided policies behind this. I don't see those events as particular conspiracies themselves, but I think there were very wrong-headed policies. So in Maui, there are issues about land use and water and even electrical wires and things like that were, huge problems, and this didn't come out of nowhere. Wildfires have been a problem in Hawaii, and, there have been huge, problems in environmental protection in Hawaii and in land use. So, yeah, a lot of misguided policy, and the failure to respond to the emergency and to really support that community and their recovery and so on is also, I think, extremely nefarious and reflects, again, the bias towards, the economic elites. In East Palestine, the nefarious problem was that the workers wanted to address the safety issues. They are so overworked right now. There are two staff railroad workers who are now responsible for safety on a 2 or 3 mile long train. This is commonplace. And they have no predictable time off. They're constantly on call and being called in. And, they're exhausted. They're exhausted. They're overworked. They are working under unsafe conditions where they can't possibly guarantee the safety of the train. And thanks to Joe Biden and the Democrats, as well as the Republicans, but the Democrats who claim to be the friend of the working person, to their shame, they prevented the workers from striking, which is a basic right of working people. When push comes to shove, they have the right to put their jobs at risk, and to strike for really critical conditions. They were going on strike here over these safety concerns, and they were forced to accept a contract they had already voted to reject, including by our supposed labor president, Joe Biden. And yeah, so to my mind, that was very nefarious. And then the EPA has been bought off to not see the problem and to basically help cover up the ongoing public health disaster and these extremely dangerous chemicals, which in my view should never be passing through a community. They should not be putting everyday communities at risk by putting these extremely dangerous chemicals in large quantities on trains that are going very close to our communities. So there are all kinds of ways where very nefarious policies were in force and still are in force. And these trains are still derailing. There are several derailments per day, and it's just kind of a matter of Russian roulette when the next derailment involves really toxic chemicals in large quantities. But the EPA has collaborated and has played a very shameful role here, again, because of the power of big money to buy off our agencies that should be protecting us, not the profits of powerful corporations. And again, a disaster needs to be declared for East Palestine. They are still in a state of disaster. Many of them cannot go home to their homes. Some of their homes are extraordinarily polluted. Many of the independent press who goes there to cover it gets sick just from like walking through that community. And there's, you know, very good documentation that extremely toxic chemicals like dioxins are still very prevalent in particular areas. It's not the whole thing, but people need to be protected. And there needs to be a presumption of caution. We should be protecting lives until it's proven safe. And East Palestine should be treated like other, you know, poisoned communities like Love Canal, or I think it's Times Beach, you know, where there were just disasters of very toxic chemicals and people were evacuated and their destroyed homes were basically paid for by the government or the corporations so that people aren't destroyed. You know, their health is being destroyed and their, you know, their property has been destroyed and their financial security. Many of these people now are totally impoverished and are dependent on handouts. It's really horrific that the corporation is being protected. Norfolk Southern here is being protected, not the people. They need to be given all the benefits of precaution and safety and protection instead of allowing themselves to, you know, be really sick and at risk for very serious lifelong and terminal disease.
It's about electromagnetic pulse attacks. How would you prepare for one? And then how would you kind of maybe put America back together if one did occur?
Yeah, so again, this is a very interesting problem that I am not well informed about. So, you know, this is a legitimate problem and it needs to be addressed and assessed. We can't just put our heads in the sand. And I think it requires a certain kind of infrastructure in order to protect our, you know, our civilization that really depends on electricity more and more. So we will need to take some steps. If this is a realistic problem, and at first blush, it sounds like this is plausible, so we need to look at it. But I think there's also a role here for international treaties, because we can't protect ourselves from nuclear war. You know, there was a time we thought, oh, you just duck and cover, you know. Well, that's been proven false. Now we know that going down into your bomb shelter isn't going to do it either, both because your bomb shelter will be blown to smithereens, but because you're going to emerge into a world where there is no food, you know, and has permanent nuclear winter. So there are things we can't protect ourselves from, and there is a role here for international treaties, which again is why we need to be team players here and not just the bully in the schoolyard. We need to be able to bring back our nuclear treaties. And in fact, there is a treaty which is now supported worldwide, the Nuclear Ban Treaty, which would make nuclear weapons a thing of the past. They are actually all illegal now in terms of international law. And we all need to comply with that. And we should be in the business of supporting all of these treaties. We've been in the business of leading the charge on tearing them apart. We need treaties, and electromagnetic pulse weapons, you know, may also be something, you know, very much in that category, that we're going to have treaties which are, subject to scrutiny and inspections and ensure that this is not a real threat to our everyday lives and our future.
Okay, perfect. Next one is about pardons. Will you pardon Julian Assange, Ross Albright, Edward Snowden, and or Donald Trump on day one if elected?
So I guess, you know, it depends on what's the crime they've been charged with, you know, and what's the sentence. Julian Assange, of course, I mean, he exposed the criminal wrongdoings of the powerful, which is why he's in jail. You know, it should be those criminals, you know, those war criminals and those corrupt politicians who should be in jail, not Julian Assange. He would be released on day one. Absolutely. Same for Edward Snowden. Ross Ulbricht, I don't know the details, but it sure doesn't sound like he deserves a life sentence for an online, you know, drug sales. That sounds like a really harsh, you know, kind of punitive, needlessly punitive, politicized sentence. And, you know, I'd say the same for Donald Trump. You know, what's he guilty of? But, you know, I mean, we have lots of U.S. presidents out there who are guilty of war crimes that, you know, in my view, are absolutely every bit as serious as Donald Trump's, you know, financial crimes, for sure. So, you know, I'd say let's see what he's convicted of and what kind of sentence he gets. I have my doubts that he's going to be convicted. It would be so inflammatory, you know, and so further polarizing. I'm doubtful that he will be convicted, but I could be wrong. What do I know? So we'll see.
Does the deep state exist? Who is it, and how would you eliminate it?
Yeah, I mean, the deep state is sort of a combination of government and top-level finance and industry. You know, it's basically the state that can govern without scrutiny, without accountability, you know, and it's our... you know, it's our security agencies, so-called, for sure, and others related to the military-industrial complex. And it's people who, in particular, stay in government. You know, I think of, what's her name? Virginia, I'm forgetting her last name, you know, who's been, like, in charge of Ukraine for... one administration after another. You know, she just rotates through. She's in the State Department. Her name will come to me in a moment. But, you know, she was just retired, which I think is great.
Victoria
because,
Nuland?
She's been a major driver.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, thank you, Victoria Nuland, yes. Yeah, it's been great to see her go. But, you know, I think of her as part of the deep state, you know, just sort of deciding herself who the rulers of Ukraine were going to be, you know. You know, she decided one guy should be out and another guy should be in. This was after the revolution, the coup, shall we say, the coup in which she and the U.S. had a big hand in overthrowing the democratically elected government of Ukraine. Corrupt, yes, but, you know, so is the current government of Ukraine, you know. Corrupt government doesn't give the U.S. the right to overthrow it. At any rate, yeah, so the deep state, how do we eliminate it? You know, this is a big question. it's not simple. It's not a quick fix, and I don't think it's a soundbite either. But, you know, I think we have to watchdog it, hold it accountable, again, get money out of politics, and close the revolving door. Those seem to be sort of the general principles of approaching the deep state, but it's going to be very hard.
Next, when does life begin, and what's your stance on abortion?
Okay, so I think that, you know, a woman has a right to her reproductive destiny, and, you know, I think when life begins is a very slippery slope. But, you know, we know that fetal viability is somewhere around, you know, 24 weeks. And there are actually very few abortions that take place getting towards fetal viability. Most are done within 12 to 16 weeks. So it's usually only in the case of the life of the mother that there's need for an abortion getting towards fetal viability. So, you know, in my view, women and men and, you know, and their healthcare providers need to, you know, decide their individual reproductive health decisions. It's not something that the government should be dictating.
Next is about the size of government. What's your philosophy on that? Should it be shrunk? Should it grow? Should it be big? Do you small government, big government? Where do you kind of fall on that spectrum?
So the Green Party supports decentralized democracy. So the closer government is to us, the better. The less kind of bureaucracy there is in between government and the people, the better. But you know, that's sort of a general principle. But to that, you have to add, what is the track record of various programs? So a program like Medicare, actually, people are pretty happy with their Medicare, less so as it becomes more and more privatized. There are more and more problems with it. But still, even so, people are generally pretty happy with their Medicare. And Medicare operates with a very tiny bureaucracy. It's about 3% of our dollars are going into the bureaucracy and the administration. Most of the medical care and the decisions that happen under Medicare are based on providers and people who can then choose their providers, and you're not restricted into these limited networks. Generally, the decisions are left up to you and your provider. Whereas in private insurance, you get restricted into tiny networks. There are all sorts of limits as to what they will and won't cover. And at the end of the day, one out of every three healthcare dollars is going to red tape and bureaucracy. That's the way that private insurance works. We are spending a mountain of money tracking minutiae to figure out who pays for it. And you've got a gazillion different payers. So one out of every three healthcare dollars, that's like well over $1 trillion a year, is going into just the bureaucracy of the private health insurance industry. That's a huge problem. Relative to that, Medicare, which sounds like a big government program, is actually a tiny program, a tiny bureaucratic program compared to the alternative, which is the private insurance industry, which is leaving millions and millions of people behind and is responsible actually for the deaths of about 80,000 almost people per year who just don't have access to health insurance under the private system. So it's very problematic. And that's just by way of saying that size alone is not the indicator. It's also how complex is it, what's its track record, and is it doing a good job? So you really have to scrutinize what is the particular program. Another one I should mention is like municipal energy. So municipal utilities that are owned by communities do a way better job. That is a government program, but it tends to be a small government program. It's administered by your local community. They do a much better job of servicing their lines. When your lines go down, they go up much faster with the publicly managed energy systems. They are much quicker to respond to the public demand. If people want renewable energy, they're quicker to do it. And it's cheaper. It's all around, it's cheaper too. So you really have to look at the particular program. It's not a question of whether it's publicly owned, governmental versus private. You really have to look at the details of the program.
Next one is
exactly.
How would you solve the border crisis, and what would you do with those that have already come into the country?
Okay, great. So we have to stop driving people out of their home countries. And we have a big role to play here, because it is U.S. wars that have created a legacy of violence. It is the overthrow of governments all over the world, from Haiti to El Salvador to Honduras. In some cases, we are helping to overthrow the government. In other cases, we are helping to maintain dictatorial governments, but we have played a really horrific role. You know, you can look at Haiti, where we overthrew their democratically elected government, Aristide, twice in the last couple of decades. We overthrew him and created the mess that Haiti is today. Hillary Clinton, then as Secretary of State, went into Haiti to personally help overturn their minimum wage law. They had raised their minimum wage from 30 cents an hour to 60 cents an hour. And that was going to be problematic for U.S. corporations, for Levi corporations that wanted to be able to sell cheap jeans. So Hillary Clinton went in at the service of big corporations and her corporate donors as Secretary of State and overthrew that. You know, that she could do that because we, as the U.S., together with France, had overthrown Aristide and their democratically elected government. So that's what's driving Haitian immigrants, you know, in a nutshell. It's the incredible poverty that they're living with, as well as the mess of their government and the violence that has resulted from just a whole series of overthrows. For centuries, actually, Haiti has been purposefully destabilized by the West, including France, of course. And, you know, you could look at Honduras, where the former president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was just convicted of drug trafficking. Well, this is a president who was protected by the Obama administration, by Hillary Clinton in particular, you know, who all campaigned on his behalf. You know, and this is just one of many. This is why we are producing, you know, a parade of desperate refugees. So, number one, we have to stop overthrowing governments. We have to help stabilize governments, not overturn them. You know, we have to support true democracies, not the rule of U.S. corporations and the military. We also need to stabilize climate change, and we've been the chief historic offender here. We need to get our own climate under control and stop undermining global agreements to get climate under control, because it is, you know, climate destabilization, it's floods, it's mudslides, it's horrific storms and drought that are also now pushing millions of people to migrate around the world and to seek refuge. And then our war on drugs also, you know, creates the power of the drug cartels. And by supporting legalization, both in this country and south of the border, instead of the war on drugs, we have been the impetus for making drugs illegal and creating the violent culture that surrounds drugs. So there are many drivers here of the migrant crisis. To fix the migrant crisis, above all, we have to shut down the spigot of violence and destabilization and climate change that we have created. And then in addition, we need to provide the lawyers and the administrators and the supportive services at the border so that we're not criminalizing refugees that we've created. Instead, we are ensuring that people are not coming in with a criminal record or fleeing persecution or a record of violence. We need to be able to do the paperwork and to give people their papers to be in the country. We need to process people humanely and quickly and then provide the means for them to work. Because when we're doing that, migrants are a huge boon to any economy, the U.S. economy as well as local and state economies. They bring tax returns to the state. And on net balance, it's been shown over and over again that migrants are actually a net positive to the economy. They're not a drain, but they should not be brought in without papers and without the without the permission to go ahead and start working and becoming productive members of society, which is why they are coming here in the first place, to flee the disasters that we have created and then becoming helpful, contributing members of society. So we need to fix this on both ends. Let's stop forcing migrations, and then let's properly and humanely process people when they're here so that they can escape the disastrous conditions that we created, and they can become contributing, valued members of their communities all over. This is the responsibility of the federal government. This should not be imposed on cities or states to deal with themselves. We can fix this. For the cost of the border wall, which doesn't solve any problem, it only actually aggravates them, it causes more deaths, and it's devastating to the environment as well. Instead of building this horrific, wasteful border wall that people can be lifted over or, you know, climb over or dig under, instead of that, we should be using those resources to provide the proper civil society and migration supports to properly and speedily process them.
When it comes to crime, if you ask the left, right, they act like there's not really a crime problem. You look to the right, they make you think you walk outside, you're going to get shot, and there's this crime wave across the country. How do you see it when you look at crime in this country? Is it high, is it low? And then what would be your policing strategy if it is high?
Great. So my understanding, and this is from actually FBI figures, that since COVID, there's been a dramatic reduction in crime rates. So it's actually in the process of going down, and it's way lower than it was when it was peaking, which was, I don't know, the 70s or the 80s, something like that. But in general, they've been going down. There was a spike during COVID, and now they're going down again. And in my view, you know, policing has a role to play here, but not the role that we give it. We should not be spending half of our municipal budgets on policing and forcing police to deal with homelessness, mental health issues, drug issues, substance use disorder issues. That's not the role of police. They don't do it well. It's not fair to them. It just generates more violence, you know, and we're seeing the numbers of police killings going up by the year, which is again a reflection that our policing is not working for anybody here. So we know how to prevent crime. I mean, so much crime is about poverty. These are, in many cases, these are petty crimes of necessity, stealing food or, you know, basic materials, you know, cars, etc. That can be put to bed. And, you know, we know that we need to provide good schools, and the quality of education should be brought up to a common level across the board. And that, again, is a role of the federal government, that school budgets should not depend on how expensive your housing is, because that guarantees you're going to have a vicious cycle here, that poor communities are going to have bad schools. So the federal government needs to play a role in ensuring that every child has a good, solid education. We need to basically eliminate poverty, and we know how to do that. You know, poverty is dangerous, and poverty is deadly. It's the fourth leading cause of death in this country, and it is a major driver. People who live in hopeless communities will resort to lives of crime when they don't have other options. So this is fixable. And instead of, you know, what is it? You know, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. It's a huge amount of money. I do have that figure here somewhere, which I will try to drag out. But we are spending a huge amount of money. Yeah, it's $100 billion annually that we spend on the failed drug war. You know, how outrageous is that? So these dollars can be spent far more productively treating these problems, and especially preventing them by ensuring that we have a basic economic bill of rights, that we have affordable housing that's accessible to people, that people have a right to a job, which the public on the whole supports. We do need to create a jobs program. This is part of our Green New Deal that would create jobs, millions of jobs, that will help transition us into the clean energy economy of the future, the sustainable agriculture economy of the future, get big ag out of the business of, you know, defining our food supply, get fossil fuels out of the business of determining our energy supply. We need to create a climate and protect our environment. We're losing our oceans, our water supplies. The Colorado River is on the verge of shutting down. Colorado River supplies the whole California agriculture system. which in turn supplies half of the fruits and vegetables for the nation. So anybody who thinks that climate change is a myth or isn't going to affect you needs to think otherwise. And drought and food supply is just one part of the problem. There are many other issues. A lot of people are getting hit now by floods and storms and recognize that, oh my God, you know, we are really up a creek right now and we need to start fixing this. So the Green New Deal would both fix the poverty problem as the driver of crime here, and it will also fix the climate issue all in one fell swoop. So that's how we put an end to needless crime.
You briefly touched on homelessness, and that was my next question. Just how would you end the homeless crisis?
Sure. So homelessness is at an all-time high right now. You know, and again, this is another kind of case in point of where the foxes are driving the chicken coop. The real estate industry is one of those very powerful financial industries, which is really calling the shots on housing policy. Right now, you have private investors, you know, you have investment capital, which is buying up single homes, single family homes. So now everyday people can no longer afford these homes because they're being bought up by a handful of investment businesses. This is outrageous. They are driving us to becoming a rental, a rental society. And at the same time, rents are going sky high. So we have to look at programs that have fixed this. And I think simply deregulating the industry is not the answer here. Regulations are important for ensuring that we have safe housing, that we have housing that will, you know, withstand whatever floods or earthquake issues there are. I don't see regulation as the problem. And countries that deregulate and that don't have principles for safety and including worker protection in building, you know, are really a disaster in the making. What we need to do is end the control of the real estate industry over our housing policy. And we need to ensure that housing is a human right, and that is affordable housing needs to be a human right. So back in the day, there was quality public housing. In my view, that public housing needs to be mixed income, and you shouldn't be kicked out of it just because you're no longer in desperate need. We need to support what's called social housing. It's used to very good effect. With relatively low investments, you can create self-sustaining public housing that is mixed income, that's high quality, that gives everyone, you know, the right to a decent and well-designed place to live, that has open space and recreation space, which is also really critical, not only for the environment, but also for our health and our survival. This can be done in the public interest instead of maximizing profit for the developer. We need rent control now more than ever, because rents are skyrocketing and eviction rates are also skyrocketing. So we need rent control so that people can stay in the housing that they're in. Doesn't mean rents can't go up, but they need to go up proportional to the cost of living. In the meantime, we also need a tenant bill of rights so that people cannot be evicted without a just cause, because right now that's just happening all over the place, and people are getting evicted so that the rents can be raised. So it's really a desperate situation for everyday people right now, and simply building more housing, which is going to build then to the market at high cost, at extremely high interest rates, that alone is not going to do it. We need to use solutions that are going to work for everyday people, not just for the real estate industry and investors. That can no longer be the basis for housing policy. We are in a state of emergency right now.
Okay, perfect. Those are kind of all my issue-based questions. Just to wrap things up, candidates make a lot of promises when they're out there campaigning. Why should anybody believe what you're saying will actually happen if you become president?
Mainly because I'm not paid to say anything here. You know, I don't take big money. You know, I don't have backers from the involved industries. In the Green Party, we do not take corporate PAC money, and we don't work with super PACs. So we don't work with deep pockets. We work with everyday people. And I will not get elected without grassroots support from everyday people. It's not AIPAC or the defense contractors or Big Pharma that wants me elected. They very much want me not elected. And it's only, you know, the people I will be accountable to are the everyday grassroots working families who are clamoring for a government that's working for them. And if ever I lose their support, I'm out, because that's the only support that I have. So I cannot abandon my base. You know, this is what's happened to the Democrats. They try to blame their loss of control on me, on third parties, you know, on libertarians even. They try to blame us for so-called taking votes away, which is like such an anti-democratic concept to start with. No politician owns your vote. You own your vote. Politicians have to earn your vote. Where was I going with that thought? Let me recollect that. Just that I cannot promise a vote to any big spender, because that's not what I'm about. I'm about everyday public interest people. And that's who I have to serve. And if at any point I stop, then I don't have a base to stay in office. And for the likes of candidates like me, who are small donor grassroots campaigns, we need the support of our base. Yeah, I think that's where I was going with that thought, that if you don't have the support of your base, no one owns our votes, and we have to own our votes. And any politician who tells you that you have to vote for them because they own your vote, no, they have to earn your vote. And if they're saying that they own it, then by definition, they should not even be considered as an option for your vote. But I'm in that position where, you know, people who support me are not because I'm taking money from them, because I don't take big money and I'm not serving their interests. So I'd say I will be held accountable by our base. The Democrats lost their base because they stopped serving their base. They threw everyday people under the bus in the election of 2010. They lost 1,000 state rep seats. They lost 64 Congress seats and 12 governorships. So they lost across the board. There was no third party to blame it on. The reason they lost was because they abandoned their base. And that is the battle that they're fighting right now. They have their real masters are not working people. They give lip service to working people, but their real masters are their big donors. We're not in that position. You know, we serve only everyday people. That's our donor base, small donors, and that's whose policies we are working very hard to advance.
Okay. Excellent. Those are all my questions. Do you have anything you want to say I didn't ask, or do you want to tell people how they can support your campaign?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Thank you so much. Go to jillstein2024.com and you can find out more and you can join the team. People are clamoring for a politics that's about us, you know, that's not controlled by the two big major parties. And as a Green candidate, you know, I have the liberty to represent what everyday people are clamoring for. And there's much overlap with libertarians, who I know are your base, in that we are not taking marching orders from the military-industrial complex. We stand strong against the drug wars, against the violation of our civil liberties. We stand for freedom of the press and freedom of the speech and all that. And in addition, I'd say Greens really stand for policies that help everyday working people, where the historic record is very clear. Top-down doesn't help. Just simply, you know, reigning in government isn't going to help unless we're also reigning in corporations. We have to really advance the cause of everyday people, who are getting really assaulted in every dimension of our lives right now. We are in a state of widespread emergency and broad hopelessness. So we need, in my view, we need a government at all levels. We are the government, and it needs to go to bat for us as everyday people. That's basically what our campaign is about, and I invite you to check it out and join it. Thank you so very much, and thank you for this wonderful interview and all the really deep questions that you're asking here, Courtney. It's really great to be asked them, so thanks for all that you do.
Now that you know where we've been, find out where we're going. Tune in to Ladies Love Politics, where you can stay informed without going insane.